Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson Show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th Commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests on Blog Talk Radio as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Let me ask you a question. How do you feel about public speaking? Like most people, does it terrify you? How do you feel before you have to give a speech? Or worse yet, have you ever had to give a eulogy? I think that's the worst thing. Do you know anything about speech structure? Do you know how to make your speech end and how to make it look like it was effortless? Well, would you like to learn something about that today? Would you like to meet someone called the Improv Guy? And he has written a book on public speaking. I'm very pleased to have him on the show today. I think he's got some terrific stuff to share with us. Before I introduce him, I'd like to have you call in. The call-in number is 818-431-8506 with any questions that you may have during our interview. I'm pleased to announce that our show today is featured on the front page at Blog Talk Radio, and I am honored to be a feature host, and we now have over 1 million fabulous listeners. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guest today. He is the founder of ImprovVentures.com and PublicDynamics.com. He'll discuss the power of improvisation as a tool to better communication, both on stage and in business in general. His book, Public Speaking Gets A's, Not Z's, that relates to presentations and speaking. In addition to discussing the power of improv and how it unintentionally led him to the more rehearsed world of professional speaking, he'll tell us about how to make your program more interesting and relatable, help us with speech structure, and tell you ways you might alienate your audience without meaning to. And then he'll give us some tricks to pace yourself to end on time and make it look effortless. And that also, he's going to deal with the plain old simple fear of public speaking that most of us have. I'm pleased to introduce you today to Milo Shapiro. Hi, Milo. How are you today?
Hey, January. I am so pleased to be here. Thank you so much for asking me.
Well, I'm very interested in someone who does improv. I've had to do it on several occasions, and it was, oh, my gosh, terribly frightening. Were you always a funny little kid?
Yeah, I think I was. I used to write skits with friends, and, you know, we put them together and we performed them for our parents and stuff, who probably were tolerating our senses of humor at third grade. But, yeah, that kind of always appealed to me. And I would watch, you know, Johnny Carson and Joan Rivers as a kid and just think, oh, that just looks like so much fun. But improv and stand-up are very different things, and I really respect the people who can just get up there and do humor on stage. That's very different than improv, where we're making it up on the spot.
Yeah, very challenging. Did you perform in school plays, and were you always keen on entertaining?
Right. I loved being on the stage with the acting and learning. The whole part I hated was learning my lines. So improv ended up working very well for me. I've never been very good at the memorization stuff. But trying to figure out what to do with the character and where the improv, I didn't know what improv was yet, but where that showed up in those days was saying, let's try this character this way today. Let's try it that way. Oh, that one got a laugh. That part stays in. I'll try something else on the next part. So that was where there was a little bit of play and improv even within a scripted play.
Okay. Yeah, I would think if you had a natural inclination to be humorous, improv would be just what you would adore doing. And memorizing lines must be a big, real chore.
It is. When I've been in improv troupes where we tried to include some sketch comedy, the hardest thing was getting anybody to rehearse the sketches because they were so used to getting accolades for what they made up on the spot that rehearsing sketches always kind of felt... we really have to rehearse. So finally, we just took the sketches out of the show and said, let's just keep it to improv.
Well, like Saturday Night Live, is that considered improv, or how would you classify that show?
I would definitely call that sketch comedy. It's very planned out. It needs to be because of the fact that there's just such fine focus on it. But lots and lots of those people came from an improv background. And in particular, one of the main stepping stones is Second City Improv, which is in Toronto and Chicago. And a lot of what happens is people who really excel there get picked up for Saturday Night Live, and then some of the characters that they've used time and again find their way onto the Saturday Night Live show. Things like the Ed Quigley character that Martin Short did, that was a Second City skit. And the motivational speaker character that screams at people that not John Candy. Oh, I'm blanking on his name. But one of the ones who became big on Saturday Night Live, that was all from their improv background, something that someone tried, worked, and said, hey, let's work on this character.
Oh, yeah. I love that show. I always TiVo it. I never stay up that late, but I love watching it in the morning. It makes my day start so funny.
And I think a lot of the times they create those characters out of improvising, going, oh, that's a fun one, let's play with it, even now on Saturday Night Live. I think that gives them ideas to write from.
Okay, when you say improv or improvisation, are those two different things, or is it the same thing?
It's the same thing.
Same thing.
Just get tired of saying improvisation over and over again.
Yeah, okay, right. I didn't know if this was a shorthand or not.
A lot of the confusion came from was that television show, Evening at the Improv, where no improv ever took place. If you think back to that famous show, it was all stand-up comedy, and stand-up and improv are very different. Stand-up is like Jerry Seinfeld, who painstakingly takes every sentence and tries it different ways in front of different audiences to see what emphasis will get the biggest laugh on that line or take out a line that doesn't work. With improv, we never do the same thing twice at all. It's we get a suggestion from the audience, and we're making everything up. So that's the big difference there.
That's a major difference.
Major difference.
Now, and I think you've kind of touched on how stand-up and improv are different. One, you're memorizing lines, and improv, you're just, you know, winging it. How did you get involved in improvisation?
I was involved in Toastmasters, trying to improve my public speaking skills way back when. This is, 89, 90 or so. And I joined a Toastmasters group called Laughmasters, which was improving your speaking but with an emphasis on humor. I just thought it sounded like more fun. Well, they always had a guest speaker, and one month instead of a speaker, they brought in an improv troupe. And I watched them, and I just sat on the edge of my seat. While everyone else was just laughing and enjoying it, I was just thinking, I've got to be doing that. I have to find out how one learns to do that, where they do it. And I approached one of them afterwards and said, how does one get to do what you do? And she said, honestly, we're not really even a troupe. We're a class with a teacher. And if somebody asks us to perform, we're so excited we go do it. So I said, give me your teacher's name. And I studied with her for a couple of years and kind of exceeded that class was mostly about having fun together, and I really wanted to perform. So that was a stepping stone to auditioning for other troupes that I got into. And eventually I got into San Diego Theater Sports, and I was with them for 14 years.
Oh, my gosh. Well, are you from San Diego?
Not originally. I'm a New Yorker. When I first moved out here, I talked like this, but I had to learn to tone it down because I wasn't getting any of my roles for acting. So over the years, I've learned to tone down my accent. This is actually my voice now. I'm not trying to put on a California accent.
Okay.
And it slips out, though, if I'm tired or drinking or talking to my parents. So I'm originally a New Yorker, and I moved out here in 89 and fell in love with San Diego immediately, and I've been here ever since.
Oh, that's great. And then you taught Laugh Masters and classes with Jackie and other troops, and you did all of those. And then what group were you with again for 14 years? What was that?
San Diego Theater Sports. Theater Sports is an international chain of improv troupes that uses a concept of having two teams competing against each other. And much as it's nice to win, in the end, we don't really care which team wins as much as did the audience have a good time watching.
Uh-huh.
But where it came from was our founder, Keith Johnstone, back in the 70s in England, was trying to figure out why the audiences in England were loving professional wrestling and not really like be excited about theater. And so he wanted to bring some of the excitement of professional wrestling. So he brought out these judges who would underrate the scene sometimes, and the audience at our shows, they could boo the judges and they could yell at them. And we created this heat, this passion at the theater sports shows. It was a lot of fun. You'd have a team that would do a scene, a team would do a scene, and the judges would give the points to the different scenes. And it was great fun. Most scenes were between 3 and 5 minutes, so in the course of a show, you might see 16 scenes or so.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
And everyone different, made up on the spot.
Mm. Okay, now, so during these 14 years that you were working with San Diego Theater Sports, what were you doing for a living? How did you pay your rent? How did you buy food to eat?
I was the odd duck. While I was working with a lot of struggling actors and stuff who improv was part of their world, I was a computer programmer for San Diego Gas and Electric, doing COBOL and CICS and all these things that I was quite good at and had no passion for. It just wasn't me. I went to college for something very practical, but didn't really figure out where did my heart sing, what made me excited about my days. So my days were spent doing that, and my nights, weekends, and even vacations were all built around improv, studying in Calgary and in San Francisco with the masters. And I was a mixed blessing of paying the rent one way and following my passion another way.
Yeah. You know, I often recommend that to people who are in jobs that they aren't happy with, to find something that they're passionate about. And even if they do it part-time, at least they've got their foot in the door and it's feeding their soul. Don't you think that's so important?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how I could have faced going to my job every day if I hadn't had something that gave me life and light during all the other times. And when I finally did leave in 2000, I was in the career for about 15 years. When I left in 2000, it gave me something that a lot of actors don't have, which is a bank account. I was stocking money away knowing that someday this might come to be for me. And then the unexpected turn was when I was offered a voluntary separation package. They went through a merger, were somewhat overstaffed, and they were willing to give me some money to go away. And I thought, wow, I've never had the guts to go away, but this might be the kick I needed. So I made the bravest and scariest decision of my whole life, much scarier than even moving across the country, and that was to walk away from a career that paid well and that I'd gone to college for and try and make some kind of a business in improv. Which sounds as crazy now as it did then, but it worked.
I often ask my guests the same question, what happened in your life that was the worst thing that eventually turned out to be the best thing, and I think you could probably put your separation package in that category, couldn't you?
Absolutely. When I got that notice, my first thought was, oh, my gosh, I must be bottom of the barrel. They want to get rid of me, and I better get out of here. As it turns out, my boss said, please don't accept the package. It's voluntary. You should not have been picked for this. My manager wasn't allowed to ask my input, and he had to guess, and he guessed wrong. Please don't take it. And I said, I can't tell you whether I'll take it or not because I haven't been shown the amount of money yet. And I learned a valuable lesson. Read the fine print. They gave me, I don't mind saying, they gave me 6 months' salary to leave because I'd been there for so long. But what I didn't notice was that it was all going to go in my 401K. I didn't get to live on any of that money. Thank goodness I had saved some money up because I had to live on that until my business took off because the package offered me nothing to pay the rent the next month.
Oh, my gosh. And see, this is another wonderful thing about having you on the show. I always ask my guests for their secrets to success.
And the fine print.
Reading the fine print. You're the first one who's ever come up with that.
And it probably wasn't particularly fine print. I think I was just so overwhelmed by everything that I missed a really big part of it.
Yeah. Well, that's a very brilliant suggestion, and I hope all my listeners will remember that. Now, then you started a company to do team building.
Correct.
Using improv, and you created a course that you called Team Provising.
Yeah, you got to write Team Provising.
Yeah, what's that all about?
One of the things that I discovered from the people who weren't just actors, the people who had the day jobs in improv, was that all of us would talk amongst ourselves about how it would pay off in every aspect of our business life. Because improv is, like I said, it's very different than stand-up. You don't know what you're going to be saying, and you're not alone. You're with other people. So the skills you develop when you take improv classes, even if you're never going to hit the stage, even if you're just taking them for fun, are listening skills, building on each other's ideas, nonverbal communication clues, how to take an idea and build on what the other person said, even if it wasn't your idea originally. And these things would pay off for me time and time again when I had to deal with clients or my bosses or new people coming on board in my day-to-day corporate job. So I realized that I could pick out improv games, ones that were simple enough for everyone to have a good time with it. Because improv, I mean, I'd rather team building should be fun, nothing against good, fun improv team building work. But I wanted my team building to be more than fun. I wanted people to walk out of it going, that's what happens in our staff meetings. Or, or I have a client who does what happened in that game to me all the time, and it's not funny there. How do we work on that? So people start bringing up their work issues right within the middle of us playing these improv games. And what started out as mostly a fun course has become a very powerful course for a group of people to go through together. And I've been told many times it's changed the way the whole office feels for just having played with each other in that way. And play is an amazing source of learning that, unfortunately, we lose track of after being kids in many cases.
Yeah, and letting the children out to play is always good for everyone's morale.
And we learn more by play. If we have enjoyed, I've seen statistics over and over that if we have enjoyed the process of learning, we are far more likely to remember what we learned, not just enjoyed it.
Yeah, I wish more school teachers would get that message. That is such a powerful statement. Let's talk about the five C's of good teamwork and how you present those to your people that you're working with.
Sure. One of the things that I say we will get out of a team providing course is a look at the five C's of teamwork, and they are creativity, cooperation, communication, community, and commitment. And if anyone missed that, it's on the website. We can get to that later. But we want to be tapping into all of them, and so I pick out games to make sure within the amount of time we have together, we touch on all five of them, and some games hit on more than one. Some people, I'll say, which of the five C's did we hit on that one? And maybe half the people saw a lot of creativity in it, and another half said that it was very much about community. As long as they're seeing the value in it, it doesn't matter which one they pick, and they might both be right. But I don't want too many of the games to be, you know, I didn't learn anything out of it. It was just fun. Unless the boss says, just throw in some games that are just plain fun, too. I don't care if they learn anything. That was one of my lessons early on, is people want different things out of a team-building course. So now one of the questions I ask is, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is, I don't care if they have any fun as long as they're learning, and 10 is, I don't care if they learn anything as long as they're having fun, where do you want this course to be? And usually I hear 5, which is great, but I've gotten 10s, where the course is a reward for a payoff of a great semester at that company, whatever. So then I can put in a few games where there's not much to learn, but, you know, they're fun. And if someone tells me it's a 2, then I got to make sure there's some serious learning going on.
Yeah. How long is your course, like a one-day course?
I designed it as a 6-hour course. And at first, you learn a lot on the fly when you start your own business because there's no guidebook. And at first, I explained to people over and over it was a 6-hour course, and I missed out on a lot of business. So now I'm smarter about it. I say it's designed as a 6-hour course, but I'm happy to do it in 4 hours, 3 hours. You know, we'll make it fit your schedule, and I have different prices according to, you know, how many hours. And sometimes 4 hours is just right, you know. And I try not to go less than 2 because it takes a while for people's defenses to start to come down and get into it. And at 2 hours, it just feels like a bit of a tease because people are really getting into it, and then we have to wrap. But you know, if they only have 2 hours, I'll do 2 hours. I've learned.
Well, you know, right now, Milo, we're going to take a break and hear about your host. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your website and your wonderful book and also a keynote speech that's coming up for you in April. We'll be right back with Milo Shapiro.
Lately, there's a whining epidemic in our world. People are even whining about whining. Are you sick and tired of listening to everyone whining all the time? So was January Jones, the author of Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reached number 1 at Amazon.com. Ms. Jones based her book on a survey of the top 10 things that people whine about at all ages and all stages of life. January is a success coach that can tell you how to help others. When you buy Thou Shalt Not Whine, the 11th commandment, you'll find out what people whine about and how to stop them from whining. This is the perfect gift book to give or get for any occasion. Thou Shalt Not Whine was voted the best gift to be given anonymously for those special people in your life. Ms. Jones is an internationally known author in the style of Irma Bombeck, specializing in housewife humor with her book being published in Korea and China. You can find Thou Shalt Not Whine at Amazon.com.
Welcome back with my wonderful guest, Milo Shapiro, and he's sharing with us his improv speaking. An improv guy on public speaking. Now, Milo, what is your website for my listeners? And tell us about your book and where they can get your book.
Okay, well, the best place to get the book is start on my website. In some cases, it's easier to get it through there than it is to go straight to Amazon because of the spelling. And I have two books, so I'll mention both of them. My website is Improv Ventures, which is the name of my business, which is like the word improv, I-M-P-R-O-V, and then the word ventures, V-E-N-T-U-R-E-S, slammed together with one V, improvventures.com. And if you can't remember that, miloshapiro.com will also get you there. So I have two books. My public speaking book is called Public Speaking, Get A's, Not Z's. And like I said, it's a little hard to spell because you have to know how many Z's are in there. So just start with Milo Shapiro. Go to the books page on miloshapiro.com. The other book is called The Worst Days Make the Best Stories. And that was that's 26 stories of things that happened either in my life or to people I knew where there was a life lesson at the by the end of the story. Most of the stories are very funny. It's been described as like chicken soup for the soul, but with a lot more humor. And that's a lot of fun. The public speaking book is also done with a lot of humor. And you'll now that you've heard me on Blog Talk, you'll hear my voice talking to you as you read the book because I write very much the way I talk. Part of the reason I wrote the book was I found that most of the books on the topic out there were kind of boring, and it's a topic I love. I'm like, if I can't get through these books without being bored, someone's got to write a book that's really fun on the topic.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you have to come back on the show because your 26 worst stories, that would be 26 shows.
I'll share one real quick. The original title of the book is was Send in the Clowns is Not a Great Wedding March. And that's based on a true story at my uncle's wedding where the keyboardist played a different tune every time two more people came down the aisle right up until the bride and groom. And as the bride's parents came down the aisle, nobody paid attention to the music but me. I don't know why I was focusing on the music. And he started playing Send in the Clowns. And the wife was so overdressed and with this beaming smile. And I burst into complete inappropriate laughter and could not stop because I'm the only one in the room who realizes he's playing Send in the Clowns. So that's one of the 25 stories with a lot less details. It's a longer story than that.
And give me the title of that again, 25 Worst?
No, it's just called The Worst Days Make the Best Stories.
Oh, okay.
And now that book is so new, unless there's people listening to this in rerun. It's new enough that you can only get it on my website. I'm happy to sell it to you, but it's not on Amazon just yet. That should be in the next couple of months.
Oh, okay. Well, when it goes on Amazon, come back and we'll talk about it because that would be one of my favorite things to talk about because I always ask that question on every show. And it's always amazing how the worst things somehow always turn out to be the very best things. And I think it's a good commentary on how life goes on and on.
One of the wonderful things about being a motivational speaker is the worst things that happen, the better the story is. Even if it doesn't turn out for the best, this will make a great story in the next speech I have to give.
Now, just let's back up a little bit. How much improv did you actually do? I mean, you did 14 years, and that was while you were working with in your IT job. And then after that, did you stop improv, or do you still do it, or what's your connection with it now?
Everything you just said, all of them are true. What happened was we founded San Diego Theater Sports in 93. It was from some people that I'd been in another troupe with. So I helped co-found it, but I auditioned for the troupe that led to Theater Sports. I was with them from 93 to 2000 when I quit my job, and then I stayed with Theater Sports until it folded in 2007. We opened our own theater, which had its pros and cons. It meant that we had complete control over the environment and the sounds and the lights, and it was great and incredibly expensive. And we just, even though we built an audience, we didn't build enough of a bigger audience to pay the rent. And we tried one final fundraiser that was a disaster. It cost us way more than we raised, and we finally had to close the theater down. I think everybody's heart just wasn't in it once we closed our own theater and had to go back to renting space again someplace else that wasn't ours. So until 2007, I was performing a lot. And then I took a few years off, and just in the last year or so, I've been getting back into the local community, finding other people who are wanting to do the kind of improv I'm doing now, more long form, where you're doing a long story over 15 to 20 minutes instead of these little three-minute skits. And I'm loving having a new circle of people that I'm rehearsing with again, but we haven't hit the stage again just yet.
Okay. And, you know, the reason that I've invited Milo to come on our show today is that I am a member of an organization called AATH, and they are having their annual convention in San Diego, April 1st through the 4th. And Milo will be the keynote speaker, and I am wondering, what are you going to be talking about to this group? They're all humorists.
They sure are. I am going to be doing my keynote speech, the one that I booked the most, called We've Got to Fail to Succeed.
Okay.
And in this speech, it takes a look at our relationship with risk-taking and failure and taking chances and what is our relationship with it. Some people are totally at ease with making mistakes. They make a mistake, okay, learning lesson. Other people never want to make a mistake. I get a lot of the engineering types who are like, there is no room for failure. Well, when there's no room for failure, there's also no room for growth. And that's one of the things we're going to be looking at in that speech. So I take stories from the business world and from my personal life and then tie that to improv. In order to do improv, you simply have to accept the fact that not everything is going to succeed. And the fundamental thought behind theater sports was, at the end of the show, when we do notes, only 80% of the show should have succeeded. If we were succeeding in 100% of the show, we generally got called to task for it because we probably weren't taking enough chances if everything succeeded. But if you fail 20% of the time, some brilliant stuff happens in the other 80%. And for about half the time I'm going to be on the AATH stage, I'm going to be leading that whole audience of, I don't know exactly how big it's going to be because registration is still happening, but I'll be leading that whole audience in playing games with the people next to them. So we're going to get real interactive and have a lot of fun, not just listen to me talk about it.
Yeah, that'll be wonderful.
I've been told it's as close to a team-building event as a keynote speak gets because we're just doing so much.
I'm sorry, I'm going to miss it. Unfortunately, I won't be there this year, but I know you will do wonderful. And that's a group that's game for anything, so you can have them do the most insane, ridiculous games, and that'll be just normal for them.
They'll be like, is that as far as it goes, really? I'm like, hey, my corporate clients can't handle this.
Yeah, I know. This group will handle anything you throw at them, and I can guarantee that. Now,
it's a wonderful association. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted to talk more about AATH. I was just going to say, anybody I've mentioned so far, because I've gone to a couple of the local meetings now that I'm a member, and the thought behind it is that we grow and we our health improves when we incorporate humor into our lives on a regular basis rather than it be an exceptional thing, see a funny movie or go see a comedian. The more humor is a part of our lives, the more it lifts our spirit and protects our health.
Oh, yes, it's such a big factor in health, caregiving, helping people heal. It's just a fantastic group. Let's go back a little bit now and talk about when you first became a keynote speaker and your transition. How did that go the first time you had to get up in front of a big audience?
Oh, it was awful. Because it didn't go the way it was supposed to. And of course, everybody says that, but it just really didn't go the way it was supposed to. I'm going to be telling this story at the AATH conference. That's how I kick off my speech. So I'm going to summarize a little bit. I apologize to your listeners, but for the people coming to the conference, I don't want to give it away. But I was invited to come up and lead the audience in some games, and for reasons that I won't go into, that became impossible. So instead, they made me make up a speech on the spot for the time, the same time slot, and I had never spoken to a large audience before, and I just started talking. I didn't even know what I was going to be talking about, but there was simply no choice. And so I had to fill 10 minutes just talking on a topic that there was no topic. I hadn't even been given a topic because I was supposed to be theme building. And at the end of it, going back to my chair, just trembling with what I had just done in front of a very important audience. This wasn't just any audience. This was an important audience to me. Someone came up to me and said, "That was great. Could you do 20 minutes at this organization for me next week?" I'm like, "What do you mean going to do 20 minutes? Didn't you just say, I have nothing. I am not a speaker." She goes, "You did 10. You could do 20. And so that was where it all came from. So I thought at that point, I'd better get involved with the National Speakers Association and learn how this organization, this career works if people are going to ask me to speak now. And the National Speakers Association has been an amazing training ground and helped me connect so well to what's the difference between wanting to speak and understanding what the business of speaking is.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic organization. So then you started with, and you became a motivational speaker.
Right.
And then how did that lead to you becoming a coach, an author, and then now you're speaking on the topic of public speaking?
Oh, my
God. Made a career out of this.
If you had told me back in 2000 that this guy who wanted to start an improv-based team-building course would be coaching people and speaking on public speaking, I just would have looked at you funny.
Yeah.
It was an odd journey. So what happened was, and I skipped a step here, was that I was doing the team-building, and people kept saying to me, you know, you need to do this for bigger audiences, not just 10, 15, 20 people in each office that hires you to do team building. So I started thinking about the keynote thing, but it was way out in the future when that story I told you just happened. So I got involved with the National Speakers Association, started trying to market myself and got some, you know, how it works, you know, first you give it away, then you charge a little, and eventually you start commanding the fees once you get the testimonials. What happened was people started coming up to me after my speeches and saying, the way you use your PowerPoint and the way you incorporate stories, because I feel so strongly about the power of stories, and the way you use your voice and your breaking points and just the different things you do, would you come and work with my staff, or would you coach me in public speaking? And at first I said, no, that's not what I do. I mean, I get up and do it, but I don't have the credentials to train you. Well, when it happened 4, 5, 6 times, I finally realized that from my spiritual background, it's like the universe is dumping this in your lap, and you are just boot-kicking it over and over.
Right.
Stop it. So to the sixth or seventh, I don't know exactly, person who asked, I finally said, well, let's see what happens. Sure. And he was selling a product on QVC. He was selling these things. It's kind of like parts of plants that you put in the dirt, and then they send out roots, and they send out the plants. They were exotic plant parts from around the world. And QVC was going to kick him off the air because he wasn't selling enough of them. So he needed help, so he hired me. And I could see, looking at his tapes and watching him work, I could see immediately what I thought he needed. And we did about 4 or 5 visits. And then he went back to Pennsylvania, where QVC broadcasts from, and did the things that I said. I watched the tape of it. He was dead on with the things I told him we needed to fix. And he sold out all of the plant products in the first 5 of his 7 minutes. And they said to him, what did you do differently? He goes, I hired a coach. And I said, and tell me you gave them my name. And he said, oh, sorry. He did that. I could have had a whole career over at QVC. So that was the beginning of me realizing I must know what I'm doing here, and I've helped hundreds of people since then. That's back in 2004. Writing the book wasn't intended. It came, again, in part from clients saying to me, what's a book you recommend? And I thought I should go out and read some and find out what to recommend, and I didn't like what I was finding. And then Qualcomm asked me for a proposal, and in working through the proposal for a training course for their people, I didn't get the gig. They gave it with someone who was more conventional. My stuff is a little more playful, and they wanted something a little more conventional. But they said they loved it, and they thought it was interesting. And I looked at the proposal and thought, wow, you know what? I just outlined my whole book writing this proposal. Time to start writing it. And by 2007, I had public speaking get A's, not Z's.
You know, it's so interesting that you said that the universe was just laying it out there for you. That's a theme we stress so much on my show, and I have opened my show up to the universe. And literally, if you want to be on my show, if you approach us, we will take you. Anyone who has something they want to share that's about success, we will take you. And people ask, how do you get over 1 million listeners? And my answer is, you open yourself up to the universe, and whatever comes your way, you take it, you embrace it, and you spread the word. Don't you agree that the universe is such a big, random, crazy, wonderful thing to encounter?
Yeah, I think that we create our realities by what we are open to, because you don't see what you're not open to. And just a wonderful example, I don't think I told you this when we first spoke, January. I've seen your name on that homepage of Blog Talk Radio, and I thought to myself, what does it take to get on this? Because I have a blog show also, and I'm not there yet. And I thought to myself, I should probably like write to her and find out what kind of guests she... And then you contacted me because you were now in my thought realm of, you know, what does it take to get on her show?
I don't
think that's coincidence. I think that's the universe saying, you know, you're open to it. Okay, now you're going to deal with it. And, of course, in this case, dealing with it was a pleasure. but if I hadn't had blog talk in my mind from starting to do it, and that, who knows if our paths would have crossed.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that so much of this plays out, and one person will tell another person, and they'll listen to the show, and they'll send me an email, and they'll say, have I got someone terrific for you? And, you know, I think by having everyone who approaches me come on the show, it makes the show so eclectic, and it makes it so energizing, because I never know what we're getting. And it's like having you, it's a wonderful surprise. And when I look at the monitor and see us up on the front page at Blog Talk Live, I hope that everyone listening will enjoy this. And I want you all to buy Milo Shapiro's book. Definitely. It's called Public Speaking, Getting A's, Not Z's.
Actually, get A's, because if they do go to Amazon, they have to have the title right. It's Get A's, Not Z's.
It's
easier to find on the website.
And you have to count the Z's. I counted six.
Yes, you have to count the Z's. There are six of them. But then you have to remember to put the apostrophes, too. I had one website that thought they were going to correct me. They thought, A apostrophe S for A's. There shouldn't be an apostrophe in there. Well, then it looks like get as, not Z's. So I had to contact them and say, please put it the way I had it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about when you're working with someone and you have their program and you sit down and you talk about the topics that I mentioned at the opening, making your program more interesting and relatable, that's the first thing that you stress, isn't it?
Yeah, we want people to listen and feel like there's a connection to the speaker rather than feeling like they're getting a textbook that happens to be out loud. So there has to be a certain amount of vulnerability to allowing yourself to be someone that people in the audience can relate to. And if we just dump a lot of data at them, what's to relate to?
Right.
So if I sense that I've got a data dumper on my hands, one of the things I need to get for them is that they need to look at how can we use stories to bring people in so that they get the moral of the story and that they're on board for what data you do have to share. I mean, of course, sometimes we have to share data. But really, at a certain point, the human brain can only take in so much data. But stories stay with us in a way that data doesn't. Like if I asked you, what's the moral of the story of the boy who cried wolf, January? What does he learn?
Well, he can't do that too often.
Right. He can't do what too often?
Cry wolf.
There you go. He can't tell lies. So that's a story that stays with us. Do you remember the last time you heard that story, though? 30 years, maybe? For me, it's probably been 40 years since someone told me that story. But the story lesson stays with us. And in speaking, if we can get our lessons across through a story, it stays with our audience. I've had people approach me years later and go, you know, I remember the story you told about such and such. And that's a really wonderful feeling.
Well, you know, that's truly the reason my show is called Sharing Success Stories, because like you, I believe that stories are things that people can remember, they can learn from them, and they can reference it. And stories, when they're personal stories, they're even more powerful. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Most of my stories that I share are something that happened to me. Or at least, if it's not to me, it's got to be darn close. I'll share a story about my grandfather in one of the speeches at the conference, and I'll share a story about my mother. But it still has that feeling of, it's my world, rather than telling, you know, Abraham Lincoln once said.
Right.
That being said, there are some good examples, and I do share one story about Thomas Edison that I think is worth sharing. And as long as it's part of a bigger process where you're getting to know me in the process.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And even in a work setting. There's, you know, just a simple little story like, last month we had da-da-da-da happen in the office. And when I found out about it, so-and-so said this. And then Ann came in and told me this. And I realized we're all talking about this. Maybe we should do a sales pitch about that. Just the fact that I told that in a little story format instead of going, statistics show that da-da-da-da-da, and our new approach is going to be, I brought people in it. I brought feelings into it. And take the technical jargon out of it when we relate to people in a story.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. You know, we're going to hear right now about this wonderful organization that I support and the organization that Milo will be entertaining April 1st through the 4th in San Diego. We'll be right back with Milo Shapiro.
What is AATH? The Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor is a nonprofit, member-driven international community of humor and laughter professionals and enthusiasts. AATH provides its members the education, cutting-edge resources, and supportive community they need to excel in the practice and promotion of healthy humor. AATH welcomes anyone who is interested in learning more about the application and benefits of therapeutic humor. Members include scholars, psychologists, counselors, nurses, social workers, physicians, educators, clergy, hospital clowns, and many others who incorporate humor in their life and work. AATH was created to disseminate information about humor and laughter, laughter play and well-being, provide a caring, supportive community of humor professionals and enthusiasts. Check out our AATH at www.aath.org today.
Welcome back to Milo Shapiro, the improv guy on public speaking, who will be speaking at the AATH convention. Milo, let's talk a little bit about speech structure.
Okay. There's an old adage that you should tell them what you're going to tell them what you've got to tell them, and tell them what you told them. And that's been taught many times over in different programs. And if you don't have another way of doing it, that's fine. That can be done. Mm-hmm. But I don't find that that's a real exciting way to do it. If I've been told everything up front, and then I'm told what I'm going to be told, and at the end you're going to summarize what I've already heard, it just doesn't have a whole lot of life to it.
Yeah.
So I use a different approach that is just as easy to do, but I find is more fun to put together the program and way more fun for the audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So what I talk about is the capture, the transition, the body, and the capper. And this is all in the book, but I'll kind of give it a quick summary here. You want to capture their attention initially with something. It may have some. It may be obvious what it has to do with your topic. It may not be. Doesn't matter as long as you know where you're going with it. Then you go to the transition part where you explain in some way, and it can only be a couple of sentences possibly, why what you just told has to do with today's topic. So you caught their attention with something fun and interesting instead of delving into the material.
Yeah.
Then you transition so they get why they just heard that if they hadn't already figured it out. Then you move into the body of the speech because that's the part I do agree with. You do got to tell them what you're there to tell them.
Yeah,
and now finally at the end, here's my theory. If you got their attention, transitioned clearly, and did the body effectively with all the other stuff that I teach people about how to do that effectively, I would hope you shouldn't have to go back and tell them what you told them because if they didn't know by now, it's too late.
Uh-huh.
So use the ending for something a little more valuable. End on a story that relates to what you just said, or a call to action, a rhetorical question that'll get them thinking, something that's a final thought that'll really leave them going, yeah, that was worth hearing. And I can't see how repeating what you already told them is going to create that.
Yeah,
so the capture, the transition, the body, and the capper, it's a fun way to put together a program and audiences really relate to it.
Well, I'm a big follower of the call to action ending because I think that's what makes people just feel wonderful about hearing a great speech, and it's something that they can take home with them. Now, what are the ways that a new speaker might alienate their audience and by mistake, not meaning to do it, but what are some things that you should never, never do?
There's a few things that do come up. Sometimes people trying so hard to be entertaining cross borders, talking about things that they shouldn't. So sexuality things, sometimes something that's, you know, it could seem so mild that you get a chuckle from 80% of the audience, but you don't hear when 20% isn't laughing, when 80% are. And one of those 20 percenters could be a decision maker that you could have just cost yourself business with. Same with politics. I saw one of the biggies in the business make a joke about the man who was president at that time, I won't say which, and he got a good enough laugh that he laughed along, but a lot of people weren't laughing. And the woman sitting next to me noticed I wasn't laughing. I didn't even know her. And she leans over to me and said, "Well, I paid to be here, so I'm staying, but I'm not buying his books now." That's bad, just for making a joke that was unnecessary. We can alienate our audiences by not feeling like we know enough about them. If it feels too generic, a good way would be age references. If I'm talking to a young audience, and this happened to me once, it was only a few young people in the audience, but it was a wake-up call for me. I made a comment about Marlo Thomas, not an inappropriate, I just referenced Marlo Thomas once or twice in something. And someone young came up to me afterwards and said, "Who's Marlo Thomas?" And I just figured he wasn't placing the name. I said, "You know, that girl." He said, "What girl?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, he doesn't even know what that girl is. Wow." So that's a way to alienate your audience, is to make references that are too old, or if you have an older audience, references that are too pop culture-ish. Just because they were alive last week and so was I, doesn't mean they picked up this week's issue of People magazine. So they might not know a Jessica Simpson from a Jessica Alba from a Jessica. There's some other Jessicas. Jessica Sandy they might know, but they won't. You know, so don't assume people know pop references, cultural references too. You know, if you're looking at that audience and you don't know where you're at, it could be a lot of people from different places. So a reference that I made to Gloria Steinem went over a lot of people's heads who weren't American born, because Ms. Magazine isn't in the news and she's not in the news a lot. So those are a few ways that people might not relate. Also clothing. If you wear clothing that's, this isn't so much alienate as distract. I've seen people wear things where you're thinking about their outfit instead of thinking about what they're saying. Look nice, look appropriate, but don't do things that are going to distract your audience by what you wear. That's a few ideas.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I agree with you totally, because I tread very carefully on this show when topics are touching on politics, sexuality, or religion. It is so easy to offend people without even meaning to. People are very sensitive on those, particularly those three topics. So you have to be very careful when you're talking about those in public.
Language, and you, too. It's just use of word choice, you know. So we have kind of the big three or four in the curse words, but the D word or the H word could be enough to make someone uncomfortable. So it may be comfortable amongst the circle of friends that you're in, but not necessarily to that audience.
Oh, absolutely. That's another good point, too. Obscenity is never good. let's talk about your trademark seven variants of vocal variety. I'm intrigued. What are these seven variants?
I hope we have time to touch on that many. But what they are as a whole is, back in the days when I was in Toastmasters, I would hear people say, "That was a good part of her speech, but she could have used more vocal variety in the middle," or "Her vocal variety got better at the end." And they kept using the phrase, and people would nod and write that down. But I always left feeling like, did she know what to do different, other than the fact that they wanted more? So as a coach, I knew I needed something a little more specific. So I created what I call the seven variants of vocal variety. And there certainly could be more beyond that, but seven's enough. If you're doing seven, holy cow, you've got good vocal variety. So the first one is volume. You can. It seems like a silly thing to mention, but you can get louder and you can get softer to create different effects with your voice. Pitch is the one that people think about most, and it's the one that most people struggle with. The ultimate bad one would be the monotone talking like I am right now, going nowhere, and that can be pretty deadly for your audience. But beyond that, we kind of have a high, medium, and low range, but men tend to have vocal variety from low to medium, low to medium, and they're a little afraid to use their high range because I don't know whether it's just a discomfort zone or they're afraid it'll sound effeminate. But if I say to you, "You know, January, I love the fact that on your show so many of your guests are people who wouldn't get an opportunity elsewhere. I went high three times in that, and it didn't sound like some kind of crazy Monty Python character. Oh, I didn't talk like this." So I have to get men to use those high registers. For women, it depends on their background. Women tend to go high to medium, and not take advantage of the power of the low. So I got to get them down there. Except the women who have been in business so long that they've cut out the high register and gone completely low to be taken seriously, and I have to remind them that you're already taken seriously, you've established yourself. Now let's get that high register back a little bit so you have as much vocal variety as possible without losing the lows.
Right,
and that can,
right.
that can take training. Sometimes people can't hear it at first, and it takes me a while to get them to hear it. Another one is speed, varying how fast you're speaking to be effective. There are times that I want to slow down. If I need to make this point sink in a lot more than the last one, I'm going to slow down that much. But something parenthetical like, and for the older people in the audience, I'm sure you already know this, but what we have to do is, notice how that part I sped up a little because it felt parenthetical. Now I'm going back to a slower speech afterwards. I can't delve into all of them quite so much, but putting breakpoints in the right places, holding sounds in different ways, using emotion to come across more fully and add life to your voice, and doing different intonations in different places. That wraps up the seven. And there's more about that in the book.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is just hearing about those encourages all of us who do public speaking to get Milo's book and read it in depth, because you've got some really good stuff here. What about tricks to pace yourself to end on time and make it look effortless? This is a big one.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know any speaker who doesn't say that that's one of the worst things is, how do I know when it's a brand new speech or when I've changed it a lot that I'm going to finish at 59 and a half minutes to be done at 60? You know, it's one of the hardest things. So there are some tricks to it that I share with people. One of them is that Q&A is the place where you have a lot of room for play. And it's the thing that people kind of hate doing the most because you're out of control. So we can talk about Q&A afterwards. It's kind of a topic unto itself. But varying how much Q&A time you take is certainly a way to end on time.
Okay.
Another one, a really good one that I use a lot, is I always know I'm going to end on a story. So the story for the speech that I like to do with the We've Got to Fail to Succeed, it's about a 4.5 to 5 minute story that ends on a note that I like. It's humorous. It's a warm feeling. If I look at the clock and I don't have 5 minutes left, I'm not going to do that version. I have two other versions where I know which details I've planned in advance I'm going to cut out, and I can tell that story in 3 minutes, or I can summarize the point of that story in 30 seconds and never tell the story at all. And any one of the three match the slide that I have on PowerPoint. So the audience has no idea that I've just cut either 2 minutes or 5 minutes out of the program. It looks like it was intended to end just there, and I get out. So just to be able to vary by 5 minutes that quickly really gives me a lot of peace of mind that if I'm running over, that's what's going to happen. If I'm running under, I might take some more questions. I might tell the story in an even longer version. But honestly, if I end a couple of minutes early, I've never heard anybody complain that they only got 57 minutes out of a keynote speech. They just get a little longer bathroom break, so that's fine.
Well, that's very wonderful about pacing yourself. I know I've learned to do that on radio, and I'm always looking at the clock. And I know when I've got 3 minutes to go, it's time to wrap it up and bring it in so that you finish with the music right where you're supposed to be. Sometimes that just takes a little practice and something you acquire from experience. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. You start figuring out what things you can stretch, what things you can rush. Be conscious of the fact that your PowerPoint has to reflect it, though. It's always an uncomfortable feeling for an audience when a speaker says, and I don't have time for these slides, and he hits the enter key 5 times, and you see things jumping past. You feel like you missed out on something you were supposed to get.
Right.
So if you can plan some slides to be single slides, where you can be summarizing, talking quicker, not quicker in speed, but quicker in what you cover, then the audience doesn't know what you intended or might have covered. Another great way of making time work is to have something that isn't on a slide that's interactive that you could put in. You know, we're running a little ahead of schedule. I was hoping we would. So now I have time to try something else. Turn to the person next to you. Now, this looks like a wonderful surprise that they got because you paced yourself well. If you didn't pace yourself well enough, they never knew that you might have done that. You just don't do the interactive thing. So having things that you can pull in and take out. Another great one is referrals. If there's something where you could take 3 or 4 minutes to explain it to them, but you can look at the clock and see, I got to make up 3 or 4 minutes. Say, I would love to tell you more about this, but I never have enough time. So there's a page on my website, MilaShapiro.com/whatever, where I talk more about this for those you want to know more. Boom, mm-hmm. 15 seconds. I just got back the next 4 minutes. I would have spent explaining that.
Okay, yeah.
But you got to plan that in advance, because if it's not on your website, it's going to show real fast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, when we're talking about dealing with the fear, everyone has the fear of public speaking. For myself, I conquer fear of public speaking by preparation. I practice, I practice, I rehearse, I rehearse. I like to go in feeling confident. What suggestions do you have for people who have a fear of public speaking and yet they have to do it?
Sure. I mean, you've hit upon one of the biggest parts of it is going and feeling safe. This is the analogy I like to use, and this often comes up when I first receive a phone call from someone who says the fear is a big part of it. I say, let's say for a moment, let's take public speaking out of it. Let's say you were a high diver, and you were up on that board, and you were nervous, and I was your coach. I could climb up on that board, and I could talk to you about visualization and breathing techniques and relaxation techniques. But, January, if there's no water in that pool, is any of that going to help you relax? Not a bit. So what I say is, what I want you to do is climb down off that board with me. Let's spend our energy on putting water in the pool. Let's make a program that you'd be proud to give. Let's work on your techniques so you know you're getting better. And let's talk about why you're probably scared, because most of us are really never trained to do this. We get good at something unrelated, and then we're asked to speak on it. And there's this bizarre expectation that since we're good, we're going to know how to speak on it well. And that's not the same skill set at all. So the time we spend in coaching, whether it's in person or if people aren't here in San Diego, I work with people on Skype as far away as Japan. We work on creating a program that you become excited to do instead of scared to do. Will there still be nerves? Yes, there should be. I get a little nervous before every time I go on stage. But I think that nervous energy channeled well just makes you lively. Carol Burnett used to be nervous before almost all of her shows. And, you know, look what she would create with that bubble bursting energy ready to come out of her. So once people get that I don't expect them to not be scared and that it's about just getting better, a lot of times the fear goes away on its own. And then preparing as well, as you say.
And, you know, going back to what we started out with, here's a tip of the hat to Toastmasters, because if you are interested in public speaking, it's a fantastic organization to get your feet wet and to learn how to speak, and you can do it in small increments. I highly recommend it, and I think you do too, don't you, Milo?
I absolutely do, with one codicil. If you have a speech to give next month, joining Toastmasters now is not the answer. if you have an interest in this, and this is something you see as something that in the long term will be good for you, then yes, Toastmasters is an amazing program. But the nature of the way it works is you'll work your way through their books and do things, you know, these little 5 to 7 minute speeches. So where it crosses over, I mean, I have a whole chapter in my book on why Toastmasters is great, and the last bit of it is, but if you want to work on a specific program, and it's a longer program possibly, or it's a short-term project, then that's the time to hire a coach. That's not the time to turn to Toastmasters.
And you know what? We're speaking to one of the best coaches in the business. Milo, it's been a pleasure having you here and sharing you with my listeners, and you must promise me that when the worst days make the best stories comes out for launch, that you will call me and come back on my show.
I will look forward to it. You've been great to work with.
Oh, and thank you, and have a wonderful time at the AATH convention in San Diego, April 1st to the 4th.
No, April 4th to 7th. I caught you earlier say that. I'm glad you said it again. It's April
4th
to
the 7th.
Yeah.
Oh,
while we were on the break, I went back and double-checked it to make sure I had it right.
Okay. Forget that. April 4th to the 7th. And I'll be doing more promos for it as it comes up. And I'm writing that down myself, too. To my upcoming, my listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our show today. And you can catch all of these interviews at constant streaming at blogtalkradio.com 24/7. My upcoming guests for the rest of this week will amaze, astonish, and they will amuse you. They are all exciting, energizing, and eclectic, just like Milo. This is the show where you hear inspiring information that will help you to become successful, too. If you've enjoyed this show, please click the follow tab under my picture and become a regular listener. We love sharing our stories and secrets for success. It's our hope we can encourage our listeners to emulate our guests today and every day. Now remember my mantra, if you think it, then you can do it. So for now, dear friends, stop whining, start smiling, and then start sharing our show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, then start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. This is January Jones thanking Milo Shapiro for joining me today and thanking you for joining me on my journey. Now be sure to take care and stay safe.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too.